Today we are in Exodus 5, which gives us the first confrontation between Moses and Pharaoh. Thus far, we've learned about Moses' history. We've seen God call him to be Israel's deliverer. We've seen Moses resist that calling, but eventually accepting it. And now in chapter 5, he finally visits with Pharaoh. So the excitement is building. And all the things that God forewarned Moses about will begin to take place. Exodus 5, verse 1. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus says Yahweh God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." This is the first we've heard of a feast as the reason for letting Israel go. We don't have a record of God telling this to Moses, but this must have been a detail that God gave him. It was spoken as a quote from the Lord. So God wanted Moses and Aaron to use this as the first request. Let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me. The concept of holding a feast to Yahweh. This foreshadows the Passover feast and all of the feasts that God will command Israel once they leave Egypt. But it also tells us about the nature of public worship. There are various components of worship, including singing and praying and preaching. Those would be the common aspects that most Christians agree on. But what some Christians don't realize is that one component of worship is feasting. We don't just sing, pray, and preach. We feast. We worship God by eating food. Praise be to God. This is why Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, and this is why churches should have weekly communion, because it is a fundamental part of corporate worship. It is a shame when Christians neglect this practice. In some churches, you only get communion monthly or quarterly or once or twice a year. It shouldn't be that way. Worship is more than a feast, for sure, but it is no less than a feast. Worship is more than a feast, but it is no less than a feast. Verse 2. And Pharaoh said, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know Yahweh, nor will I let Israel go." Pharaoh did not respond favorably to Moses' request. His reaction was to mock and be dismissive of God. When he said, "Who is Yahweh? I don't know Yahweh." Surely this didn't mean that he had never heard of Yahweh before. After all, he was enslaving the Hebrews. They had been in his country for many generations. He would have known about their religion and their God. His meaning was, "Why should I obey this God of yours? I have no relationship with him." And this is very similar to the previous Pharaoh in Exodus 1. A new king arose in Egypt who did not know Joseph. To not know Joseph or to not know Yahweh means to not know them in an intimate or covenantal sense. Think of Genesis 4. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain. But Pharaoh flat out said that he would not let Israel go. Verse 3. So they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to Yahweh our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword." One thing to notice in this interaction is that Moses and Aaron remained respectful. They remained respectful. Even though Pharaoh was a bad guy, they still went to him peacefully, asking to hold the feast. That was their first strategy. And when Pharaoh responded sinfully, they still approached him with respect. Please, let us go, lest God's judgment fall upon us. It wasn't, hey, you're a bad dude and you need to let us go because you've been unjust. Let us go or else judgment will fall on you. They didn't say that. They kept it objective, not personal, and they focused on God's will for the Hebrews. And I think this is an instructive strategy for us. There are many wicked rulers throughout the world and, sadly, even in the church. But we are still to respect the office that they hold, recognizing that they were put into power by God and that they have greater authority than we do. Now, that doesn't mean you can't confront them. When they are in sin, you should. But when you do, you don't begin with the most abrasive line of attack. No, you remain as peaceful and calm as you can. Even Peter tells us to defend our faith, to give a reason for the hope that we have, but he says to do so with gentleness and respect. Gentleness and respect. This second request from Moses and Aaron contains another component of worship, which is sacrifice. Let us go 3 days' journey and sacrifice to our God. In the Old Covenant, the primary way that people worshiped was by offering sacrifices to God. These were usually animals that were killed and put on the altar to be burned up, with the smoke rising up to God's presence. In the New Covenant, because of Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, we do not offer animals anymore. No more blood is to be shed for the remission of sins. But this doesn't mean that sacrifice is absent from New Covenant worship. Far from it. Peter says we offer up spiritual sacrifices. Paul says we are to give a sacrifice of praise to God. Christian worship still includes sacrifice. And this is why we worship liturgically. The outline of liturgical worship, with a call to worship, the confession of sin, preaching, tithing, communion, the benediction, this order follows the same order as the Old Covenant sacrifices. Confession is our sin offering. Hearing the word is our ascension offering. Tithing is our tribute offering. Communion is our peace offering. And by the way, these categories are listed in your bulletin in the margins. So if you've never noticed those before, pay attention and you'll see which section we're in that corresponds to the sacrifices. Christian liturgy also matches the order of heavenly worship that we see in the book of Revelation. The old covenant sacrificial system followed the heavenly pattern all along. This is the primary reason we worship liturgically, because our worship takes place in heaven. That is the spiritual reality. We have ascended into God's presence, and if worship takes place in heaven, then it should look like heaven, and it should sound like heaven. We follow the same pattern. So never forget the sacrificial and heavenly aspect of worship. Worship is also a sacrifice of your time and your energy, and for many of you, your gas mileage. Jesus wants you to come to worship even when you're tired, even when it is inconvenient. It is your sacrifice of praise. He will be blessed by your sacrifice, and you will be blessed. Verse 4. Then the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your labor. And Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labor. What mattered most to Pharaoh was that the Hebrews kept working. If he let them go to worship Yahweh, they wouldn't be working. They'd have to stop working, and that was unacceptable to Pharaoh. This highlights how severe the Hebrew enslavement was in Egypt. They were not given days off. They were not given days off. It was a daily grind with no rest. The need for rest is a major theme in Exodus. God will deliver Israel and give them rest from their labors, literally. After the Exodus, God instituted the weekly Sabbath. Israel was to rest from their labors one day out of seven. And Pharaoh was exactly right that worshiping Yahweh meant resting from labor. You cannot work your regular job while offering sacrifice and holding a feast. You have to have time off in order to worship. And so this connects worship with rest and with Sabbath. In the New Covenant, our day of worship is Sunday, the Lord's Day, not the Jewish Saturday Sabbath. But the idea is largely the same. To attend worship on Sunday morning, you must rest from your labors. You cannot work on the farm or at the grocery or at the power plant and attend worship at the same time. This is why Christians should strive to find jobs where they have Sundays off, at least in the mornings. And I know that's not always possible in today's world, okay? So there are exceptions. But it should be a high priority for a Christian to look for opportunities to have Sundays off. Your day of rest isn't for you to stay home and do nothing. Your day of rest is for you to assemble for worship. Pharaoh didn't want the Hebrews to rest, and he didn't like that they asked for time off. So what did he do? He made the workload even harder for the Hebrews. Pharaoh told the taskmasters to no longer give straw to the Hebrews. Back then, they used straw to make brick, which meant packing mud and straw together and letting it dry and harden. They had a quota or a certain amount of bricks that they were to make every day. And up to this point, the Egyptians had been supplying the straw to them. But Pharaoh said, don't give them straw anymore. Make them gather up their own straw and don't reduce the quota. Don't reduce the quota. Israel now had to meet the same quota of brick with the added responsibility of getting their own straw. So the taskmasters gave the command, and naturally, the Hebrews fell behind. They were not able to meet the daily quota. And it says in verse 12 that they gathered stubble instead of straw. They were finding smaller scraps of grain that weren't as useful as straw. So on top of the increased workload, their materials were of a lesser quality, and the final product would not be as good. When Israel couldn't meet the quota, the Egyptians beat them, saying, "Why have you not fulfilled your task of making brick?" And this caused Israel to cry out to Pharaoh for relief. They said, "Why are you dealing thus with your servants? There is no straw given to your servants, and they say to us, 'Make brick.' And indeed, your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." Their point was that Pharaoh had created an impossible situation. They couldn't meet the quota because of his unreasonable decisions, yet they were blamed for it and they were beaten for it. Pharaoh responded by doubling down. Verse 17, "You are idle, idle. Therefore you say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to Yahweh.' Therefore go now and work, for no straw shall be given you, yet you shall deliver the quota of bricks." Israel knew that they were in trouble because Pharaoh was not going to let up. Appealing to him was of no benefit. They were stuck in this situation. And whom did they blame for this situation? They blamed Moses and Aaron. Verse 20. "Then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them. And they said to them, 'Let Yahweh look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us.'" Israel had initially heeded Moses' voice, just like God said they would. But when they saw the outcome of Moses going to Pharaoh, when they saw that their workload was harder, their attitude toward Moses and Aaron changed. And quite severely, "Let Yahweh look on you and judge." Some people interpret this to be a curse of sorts. They wanted God's judgment to fall upon them. Before, they called on God to look upon their afflictions in Egypt, but now they were calling on God to look upon Moses and Aaron. They were the new problem. They were the new cause of affliction. That's how the Hebrews saw it, even though Moses and Aaron did nothing wrong. How do you think that made Moses feel? Not good. I'm sure it was hurtful. And the fears and doubts that he had previously, they all came back. Verse 22. "So Moses returned to Yahweh and said, 'Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it you have sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered your people at all.'" And this is how chapter 5 ends. It doesn't end in a good place. It doesn't end with peace and vindication. It ends with Moses complaining to God, and you could say blaming God. "Why have you brought this trouble? I did what you told me to do, and it only made things worse. You said you were going to deliver Israel, but you have not done that at all." So the Hebrews were upset with Moses. Moses was upset with God. For Christians, this is a difficult spot to be in. When you see injustice and oppression, and perhaps you're the victim of those things, but when you stand up for truth, when you confront the bad guys, when you cry out to God for deliverance and it never happens, you can find yourself in a depressing state of mind. But notice that Moses still went to God. His hurt, his anger, his frustration, he took them to God. It is much better to be in that place than to forsake God altogether. When things like this happen, God wants you to turn to Him. He wants to hear your complaint. He wants you to wrestle with Him. This is how God matures us. This is how God gets us to trust Him even more. You complain to Him and you wrestle with Him, but you're supposed to do it with gratitude. You do it while giving him thanks and showing him honor. That is how you approach God respectfully. Another thing we learn from this is to not respond like the Hebrews did. Moses and Aaron obeyed God. They did what God told them to do. But their obedience didn't seem to work. It only made things worse, with Pharaoh responding hatefully. The Hebrews were wrong to blame Moses and Aaron for that. Who was to blame for Pharaoh's actions? Pharaoh. Pharaoh was to blame. That is who they should have blamed, not the innocent. We have to understand that obedience to God and the outcomes of obedience are two separate issues. Let me say that again. Obedience to God and the outcomes of obedience are two separate issues. We are to obey godly commands and principles from Scripture, and we are to do so regardless of the consequences. The consequences are up to God. They're not up to you. Sometimes obedience does not give you the results you hoped for. Sometimes it makes things worse because evil people like to double down. When that happens, you cannot blame the obedience. Do not blame the obedience. The obedience was right and good and necessary. If the consequences are bad, that's not your fault. You did what God wanted you to do. If others react sinfully, the fault is in them. Be encouraged by this and make sure that you don't blame the consequences on the faithfulness of others.